Let me pull back the curtain a little bit on the show. This is Ian Punnett with a face for radio and a voice for print. I'd have a headache since about Thursday or something, even last night doing the show, which I greatly enjoyed, but had a tough time throughout the night. Just had this real banger of a headache. I had a lot on my plate, but doing a lot of stuff and kind of crammed a lot in these last 72 hours. And it was almost like I've been looking so forward to tonight's show that there was like a kind of euphoria, a kind of healing euphoria that came over me. I'm so grateful that our two guests have agreed to pop up here on this Sunday night. The first I'll tell you about is next hour's guest. The book is Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and Cancer-Causing Monkey Viruses Are Linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK Assassination, and Emerging Global Epidemics. I might add in there, there's an interesting little twist about Nazi doctors living in South America and a kind of racist cabal that was using people against their will to be test dummies for these viruses. Other things in this book by Edward Haslam, who will tell us the whole story coming up next hour. You don't want to miss it. I'm impressed with the research he's done, the amount of time of his own life that he's put into telling this story. He'll tell it to you coming up next hour, and we'll find out why this investigation that he did paralleled an investigation being done by 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes, as we learn in the book, had invested so much into this story that it became the most expensive piece to never run in the history of 60 Minutes. And you'll hear about both what 60 Minutes had that confirmed the story of Dr. Mary's Monkey, and then ultimately why they didn't run it. Coming up when we talk with Edward Haslam next hour, he'll tell you everything. No, he's not holding anything back. The foreword for this book is by our friend Jim Mars, and there's a reason why. It's going to be great, and I'm looking forward to it on Coast to Coast AM. Now, coming up this hour, Bob Fletcher has agreed to come on, too. And I don't know quite where to begin with Bob, except he's already lined up and ready to go. So I'll skip through crypto news, and we'll just get right to it. Was Sonny Bono assassinated? Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, I'm looking forward to Dr. Mary's Monkey coming up next hour on Coast to Coast AM, but Bob Fletcher, who's also spent some time investigating a story close to his heart, 10 years of your life, Bob, is that a fair estimation?
Oh, well, certainly not full time, but it has been 10 years, and actually, it was the tail end or a follow up in my situation. When Sonny was killed, I had previously supplied him with a very extensive, in depth investigation on CIA and other people's persons that are at high level of our government connected to drug smuggling, murder, financial fraud, et cetera, et cetera. And I had already been a federal witness. I was involved with the Iran-Contra investigations. I was a sworn witness in a racketeering action, the Christic Institute's action. I had assisted 3 or 4 different congressmen and senators with other inquiries relative to several of the really major concerns in terms of corruption at the very highest levels of our government.
Sure. And so
go ahead. Excuse me.
No, sorry. You're jumping ahead a little bit there, and I want to ask a little bit more about your bio, and then we'll get into the story. It says here you're a retired investigative researcher. So what were you generally? What were you doing for a living as an investigative researcher? For whom were you investigating?
I worked for several people, but my story was an amazing one. It was back in the mid '80s. I was actually a toy manufacturer, and I got involved with the Iran-Contra business. And what had happened, I merged my company, which was in Atlanta, Georgia.
In Marietta, wasn't it?
In Marietta, Georgia, just north of Atlanta.
You were the factory that was near that Lockheed Marietta air base.
Right. You could almost hit it with a stone.
I lived out there. I lived not too far from there, actually. I lived in Atlanta, and there was a golf course that was nearby there. I went to lunch a couple of times, and as some friends were golfing out there. It's a wonderful part of Georgia, and I know almost exactly where your toy factory was. How did you end up getting involved in Iran-Contra from a toy factory?
Well, that's what I was asking myself a couple of years after it took place. Again, I had no interest in politics, could have cared less. I was pursuing my first $1 million with the American dream. I had created a little toy, and it was extremely popular. I couldn't make enough of them.
What was it?
It's like a puppet. Type little animals. The company was called the Animal Factory, and it was a little spring-loaded, like a slinky inside the body of a raccoon, a skunk, and a fox, and a couple other animals. And it's made out of real rabbit fur, and they absolutely look like they were live animals. And my brother still sells a similar toy that I no longer manufacture, and he's been selling them for 30 years now, because it goes back that far.
Sure. So how does making little toys like that get you involved?
Here's what happened. And I went to a New York show for a merchandising show, and I met 150 different people that were probably interested in my product. And one of them handed me a business card, which I just stuck in a stack and took home a couple of days later from New York back down to Marietta. And when I was reviewing the cards, going over the business cards of potential distributors for my product, I noticed that one of them was actually almost my address, which was really bizarre. And what it turned out to be that in the industrial park that I was functioning in, it was actually a company across the street. And I had never met the people, but that's where they were. And when I called them, I could actually see them answering the phone.
Wow.
And probably, although I had no reason to think something was strange other than that it's unto itself was unusual, I probably should have been more concerned about it. But at that time, I just thought it was bizarre. I struck up an acquaintance with him, which was real easy because I just walked across the street, and I set up a contract, and initially they purchased a good number of my toys, and in a short time later, only a couple of weeks later, he made me a proposition to expand my company by merging with his company, and his company on the outside was the importing of cheap watches.
Hmm.
However, to kind of get to the point of what took place, the bottom line is this guy was a covert arms dealer functioning for the United States government.
How about that?
He was utilizing the watch company as a covert front.
Right.
And then converted my toy company to the exact same use.
Now, why did he need, if he already had a successful cover in the watch company, and again, we'll get to all of the Sonny Bono stuff coming up, but I am curious about this. If he already had a successful front operation, why did he need to bring you into his intrigue?
Well, I believe after this, let's say 6 months into this whole mess, when I had met General Singlob and General Heine Adderholt in my toy company, who, by the way, were the key people in the Iran-Contra business, but basically they were the guys that ran Air America in the Vietnam War. And after a few months into their merger, I realized, and they were trying to bring myself on board. And the reason was, apparently, I had previously, prior to opening my toy business, I had about 3 years under my belt dealing with the country of West Africa, and I had what I had was a again, it was my own company, and it was an international consulting firm. And my partner was a black gentleman out of Washington, D.C., who actually was at the embassy for the country of Liberia. And we had done 3 years of miscellaneous international exporting and importing, et cetera, et cetera. So because the gentleman, that call him a gentleman, that's kind of not proper, but the character that had drawn me into this mess made a point about, maybe 2 months into our merger, where he said that I'm aware that you have been doing, you've been working with the Africans, et cetera, previously. And I said, yes. And he says, and you get along with them well, et cetera. And I said, yes. And he says, well, I want to talk to you about going into Angola. So the bottom line was they wanted to utilize myself and potentially my experience dealing with, at the ambassadorial level, dealing with people in Angola. We were about to carry out covert military arms into Angola.
And they were, and here you were getting dragged into this. What an interesting glimpse then. It's almost a precursor of some of the other stuff you're going to get into here with the Sonny Bono stories, but I appreciate you sharing that. And so when the Iran-Contra story broke, if I can just move ahead a few squares, when the Iran-Contra story broke, did you end up having to testify to Congress? I mean, were you involved in that at all?
Yes, I was. What happened when that was starting to break, I had already been, my company had already crashed. They had stolen it from me. They owed me, I don't know, it was $250,000 or something. I had pulled out because now, by that time, the time between getting involved and the Contra thing breaking, I realized I had been taken. I already drawn in my lawyer, and to our surprise, by that time, I had already received a notification out of the White House that the toy factory had been classified as secret, and I would not be able to pursue any legal, what would be very simple contractual legal lawsuits.
They to get already, your money back.
They had already right. Yeah. Either I wanted my company or my
money back. Yeah, right. And they put you in a category then where suddenly you were part of something much bigger than you ever would have bargained for.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
No way you could get out of it.
Right.
What a nightmare.
Emilio Estevez, the motion picture producer and actor, et cetera, Martin Sheen's son.
Sure.
When he read a rough draft of my book, his initial reaction was, and I will quote him, "This is the greatest thing I've read in 5 years." And it was only because of the sensitivity of some of the politics involved in my story is the only thing that stopped him from doing a motion picture in which he was going to play myself as the lead role. He said it was the greatest thing that he read since reading the story, The Firm, the motion picture, The Firm.
Right.
And, because he says it's so close to it. And of course, that was an attorney that was sucked into criminal attorneys. And in my case, I was just a toy guy drawn into covert military operations.
So how did you end up then as sort of on your own continuing to investigate covert operations being done by the government?
Okay, well, what happened was with the Iran-Contra situation, I contacted, also running simultaneously with the Contra inquiries, Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts was in the process of flipping over a lot of rocks himself. And I heard a speech that mentioned some of the names that were people that were directly in my toy factory. And I simply picked up the telephone, contacted Senator Kerry's office, and I told him briefly, I just gave him a few names, et cetera, and he said, "You're right in the middle of it. You know, we need to talk to you." Then I proceeded to talk to a couple of the congressmen that were involved with the inquiry, and next thing I know, they sent into down to my home at that time. As a matter of fact, I had moved to Orlando, Florida, and they sent in the two key investigators from the Iran-Contra inquiry. And of course, what I found out later, these guys were actually not only the key investigators, but they were also the two primary guys that shut every single thing down that was possible in terms of doing any kind of an honest investigation. Mm. Anytime they got into anything that was really hairy, such as all of the drugs and the drug-connected stuff, they just lied and shut it down.
Well, let me give some background for people that don't know, because then you can fill this in. I mean, Iran-Contra being this attempt to divert money from arms sales and then use that money to pay for the covert operations for the Contras to overtake the communist dictatorship, right, of Nicaragua?
That's correct. And okay. What the involvement there was, unfortunately, was that they were bringing drugs up from South America, and they were sending arms down. And it was being done by a handful of guys that do and have done for 30 years all of the arms smuggling and all of the major, when I say arms now, they were moving missiles and aircraft were being sold through my toy factory. I'm not talking pop guns and BB guns here. I was talking about $65,000 each Hellfire missiles and $20 million aircraft being sold. When I say that, I'm not saying that they were in the back of the toy factory. They were obviously just functioning.
Right.
You know,
the paperwork
the
was
deals.
Right. Right. Yeah.
However, and it's all the same guys. It's the same people that originally did it. And every time you see some kind of a small war or even a big or a medium sized one, any place on the globe, for 30 years, it had really been the same handful of guys. General Richard Secord, General Heine Atterholt, General John Singlob, and then all of their associates. And, of course, it involved Barry Seal, which people may recognize as a drug operative out of Bill Clinton's Arkansas. And, again, this was during originally when was Ronald Reagan president, George Bush Sr. as vice president, who was the key functioning person in the White House during that time anyhow, and he was the one that was cooperating and coordinating with people like Oliver North, who became famous for getting caught,
right.
And the Barry Seal connection out of Arkansas. Bill Clinton and Vice President George Bush Sr. at that time had been functioning together for a long time, very cooperatively. So when they got running against each other and throwing all of those political rocks at each other, it was mostly just put on.
And that was because the story was that they were making these direct shipments to Arkansas, to air bases in Arkansas, where the drugs would then be redistributed around the United States.
Right, and not even air bases, but into the backyards of wealthy farmers and things of that sort. But basically that's right. The drugs were coming in to other parts of the country as well. They ship them in under a central intelligence, a top secret shipments. Nobody is allowed to even go near the aircraft. They flew them right on into our American air bases, wherever they set it up to do so, ship them in usually with markings on them, medical or medical supplies or something. Nobody ever got to look at them. They'd fly them in, offload them, and then unload weapons and fly them back down, the weapons down to wherever they're doing their deeds.
Well, we're coming to the bottom of the hour, so let me see if I can't lay this out in an easy timeline. So you're running this profitable little toy factory in Mayreta, as the locals might call it.
You have lived there.
I have lived there, and so you have this toy factory. You get drawn into the Iran-Contra scandal through a neighboring company that needs to use your company to increase their cover in what they're doing. You lose your company, but you gain insight into what's actually happening, and you just start your own little research into this drug operation. We got about 30 seconds here. Is this what you came up with when you began to, when you put together this profile that you brought to Congressman Sonny Bono?
Well, going an awful lot between that time, because that was approximately 1987.
Right.
Between that time and on up into the early 90s, because of my activism, being totally overwhelmed with the idea that that my toy factory was to be classified top secret just to cover these renegade characters.
You're gonna have to hold on that thought till after the break, and we'll explain how Bob Fletcher believes Sonny Bono ends up getting assassinated for this on Coast to Coast AM next. So we're talking with Bob Fletcher, who went from an innocent toy manufacturer embroiled in an international political scandal, which almost brought down the Reagan administration, almost kept George Bush from being elected president on his own. But it certainly turned Bob Fletcher into a much more curious fellow who continued to look into government malfeasance after he lost his toy factory. And that's what brought him to Sonny Bono. And that's what may have gotten Sonny Bono killed. We'll tell you what Bob Fletcher thinks about that autopsy and why he believes that Sonny Bono was assassinated next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So much of what Bob Fletcher has spoken about will sound familiar when we talk with Edward Haslam coming up next hour, the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, How the Unsolved Murder of a Doctor, a Secret Laboratory in New Orleans, and cancer-causing monkey viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and emerging global epidemics. It's a story that you'll never forget. I can't wait to talk with Edward Haslam coming up next hour. Enjoying my conversation with Bob Fletcher quite a bit. Bob, what was actually in the report that you brought to the offices of Sonny Bono after he had become a congressman from California?
Well, the big point was, or actually there was many points in it. It's I completed the report and I put it onto a video form at that time because it was two parts. One of it was documentation, physical paperwork that I had generated over, which is a long period of time, prior to getting it into Sonny's hands. It was an accumulation going from 1987 all the way up to almost 97, and it was several investigations that I had been involved with, and I didn't just jump from the toy factory problem and the Iran-Contra thing 10 years forward to all of a sudden having some information. And it involved the expose, the physical expose of people at the highest levels of Washington, D.C., involved with drugs, money laundering, the weapons, how it was done, when it was done, who did it, et cetera, et cetera. And it is really an overwhelming report unto itself. And when Sonny finally reviewed it, they gave me a call. I was still living in, at that time, I was living in Los Angeles. And I received the phone call, and a fellow I had been supplying information to Sonny in his offices for about 3 or 4 years, name is Frank Cullen. He was the guy that ran his office. It was his press guy. However, he was actually an administrative assistant that ran the office. He said Sonny had freaked out. Sonny was tremendously upset. However, he said the good side was that Sonny was going to be on the Congressional Intelligence Committee for the first time for Sonny within a couple of weeks, beginning in 1998, January, right after the Christmas holidays, and that, in fact, he was going to, first thing on the calendar, was going to be initiating an investigation using at least 3 or 4 major points in my report, and they asked me if I would be on board to help him and assist him, and would I supply him with anything else, and witnesses and all of that. I said yes, and it was great, and I said, let's do it. And Sonny was excited because he was going to have full subpoena powers to force people that they would either answer questions or go to jail. And because he had been involved with the watching or investigating the Waco stuff and the Oklahoma bombs and all of that, and he was just up to his eyes with the in terms of being upset with corrupted government. And the last thing I said to Frank was, good, have a good Christmas. Call me as soon as you guys get back from the holidays, and I will fly into Washington, D.C., whatever you want me to do, and we will get this thing going. I said, let's do it. Ten days after that call, Sonny was dead on the slopes in Nevada.
Now, the story was that he was going downhill fast, had fallen forward, and crushed his skull into a tree. Why do you believe that didn't happen?
Well, it took me a long time to get any part of the autopsy. As a matter of fact, the first thing that caused a red flag for me was the day after his death, I called my friend of about 4 years, Frank Cullen, called him in Washington to offer my condolences and share my shock with him, actually. And he would not take my call. Now, instantly, I thought, uh-oh, here we go. What's going on? So it took me a couple of weeks and a couple of months and a few letters, and I got no response ever again from the guy that I used to share lunches with when I was in Washington, and a guy with whom I had dealt with for a few years and considered him a friend.
Sure.
He never talked to me again. So now I really, it cranks up my concern that that Sonny may have been taken out. He was about to launch this investigation that, trust me, the materials involved and what he planned to do would have made the Iran-Contra thing look like a walk in the park. It was that serious. And it was one of these cases, situations where once they realized, I say they, whomever the people are that decided they could have to have him removed, once they realized that Sonny was going to be able to do this and do the inquiry the way he wanted to, they had to eliminate him, and that's what they did. So no, I finally got to try to answer your question. Yeah. I get the autopsy, finally. His own mother couldn't get it. It took her almost a year and a lawyer and a couple of investigators to actually get any of the paperwork. They totally were keeping it to themselves. When I got the autopsy and first went over it, I almost fell off of my chair because there's a whole multitude of problems. And first off, one of the main problems with the autopsy is that, and also the location. He was in a treed area that was very flat. You could not reach a high speed in that area. He was 120 to 150 feet off of the path. He was in this little wooded area. The tree that he theoretically hit is surrounded by, there's a big log in front of it. There's a big rock, a boulder to the left of it, and a bush behind it. And you would have had to almost aimed in order to hit the tree. The sheriff himself, who, by the way, technically is the coroner in the state of Nevada, he said himself on videotape that for some reason, Sonny did not put his hands up to try to stop running into the tree. He tried not to prevent running or to fend off the collision. Now, that's almost a physical impossibility. If I throw a ball at your face, you're going to put your hands up and stop it.
Right.
It's almost a physical impulse. It's a natural response. It's not even a thought process. I thought that was peculiar, and apparently the sheriff did too, enough to actually mention it one time in one of the press interviews. Then you get on farther into it, I find out that the wounds primarily are in the frontal right side of the forehead and the temple area. However, for some reason, the wounds themselves are actually pieces of the skull are of a small curved configuration in the head, the skull.
Like the trunk of the tree?
No, a curved as in the size that fits the front of a barrel of a 45 a gun being pistol whipped. The tree was approximately 18 inches in diameter, would not have left curved, small curved indented figure configurations in the top front of the skull.
Now, what about a branch or a knot in the?
No, absolutely not. There is none. The tree is what they call a pole pine, which is what they used to use or still do for telephone poles. And it looks like a telephone pole. There are no branches at the low level at all.
Okay.
It's just a round trunk of a tree. Then we get looking at it and we find out, this gets a little bit technical, but when a person hits the floor or hits a windshield or hits anything with their head going at a high velocity into something, a standing object, they have what's called a contra coup injury, which means an opposite or against injury, and it is the bruising of the brain on the backside of the head. And that takes place when a head moves forward and hits a solid object.
Right.
All right. Sonny did not have that at all. There was no contra coup brain bruising in the back of the head. If you're hit, somebody hits you in the head a handful of times with a blackjack or a pipe or a pistol and kills you that way, you do not very often get that contra coup, and he did not have it. Next point, we find out one of the most glaring points, and that is that quite often people that have a collision with anything at all, on skis, all right, they die. When they die, they will maybe fracture their skull, but quite often the death is from a broken neck or neck injuries.
Like a spinal compression or something where the shock happened.
Sure. If you're talking about 30 miles an hour head on into a tree, you will break your neck and or get one heck of a real serious injury. Sonny Bono had absolutely no injury to his neck, no trauma.
And no compression on his spine and none of his back or anything like that?
Nothing of that at all. Now, when you mentioned back, here we go with another totally bizarre situation. The back of his jacket, he was wearing a ski parka. There was a slight tear on the back of the jacket. It was a little L-shaped tear in the back of the jacket. And he was wearing three different shirts, layered clothing, plus the jacket. There was blood soaked through the jacket and all three of the other shirts that he was wearing down to his undershirt. They were all stained with blood, a considerable amount, according to the autopsy.
Not his.
There's no wound on Sonny Bono's back whatsoever. There was no wound on his back. Now, sometimes you get what's called blood transfer in moving a body, but you're never going to get enough to penetrate through four layers of clothing. And I did a laboratory experiment with that. We duplicated it, and with about 14 drops of blood going from the outside into around that tear and into the clothing, we were able to absolutely perfectly duplicate what was described in the autopsy in terms of the blood stain. So it really starts to look strange. And then, of course, we have the other side of it, and that was that Mrs. Bono, Sonny's mother, was unable to get the paperwork. They were and she was screaming herself in her wheelchair at the site of the funeral. She was yelling that somebody needed to look into it because that he was murdered. I mean, she is absolutely positive. I've been working cooperatively with the lawyer that had worked with her for a few years to try and do a little more investigating into this thing. And she now has passed away. And on her deathbed, she had requested that the investigation continue until at least we got an adjustment in what the cause of death was. Now, and that's what we're doing.
And that's what we're doing. Let me ask you then, just to lay out, and we're talking with Bob Fletcher, who has been investigating off and on the death of Sonny Bono, after Sonny had pledged as a congressman to look into some of the work that Bob had approached him with. What do you think happened? How do you, in your head, as you imagine it, what happened?
I believe a hit was put out. Somebody was signed on to eliminate Sonny. They knew he was going up. And by the way, one time when I went into the offices in Washington, they told me, they said, don't come in right now. The security people are going over the offices because somebody had broken into them and that there was telephone taps inside the offices in the congressional office in Washington, Sonny's own offices. So somebody knew, obviously, the people that are in the limit in the small circle there, they would have known about the investigation. They put out a contract. Two guys, I'm assuming, somehow either had an intended meeting with him that nobody necessarily knew about, or they kind of railroaded him one man or another. That could be done by a handful of things. Faking an injury or something like that, to draw him off of that beaten path, so to speak. And then it took the two guys. One guy grabbed him, held on to him. In the scuffle, it tore the back of his jacket, and he got a bloody nose.
That's the guy you believe, the person who was holding
Sonny Bono. In the back, got a bloody nose. Got 15, 20 good drops of blood down the back of Sonny while the other guy was hitting him. It would have been a guy with a left-handed guy striking him head-on with whatever he had in his left hand facing Sonny. All the injuries are on the right side of the head. By the way, he only had bruises around his right eye, and his nose was not even seriously broken. There were fractures that came down from the impact area, but not what you would call an individually separate smashed nose, and his cap and his goggles are totally gone. They are not referred to on the inventory at the time of the autopsy or any other list at all. They're gone. We've not found the goggles or the knit cap that would have been covering the area had he run into a tree.
Sure.
There is no tree debris described in the autopsy on his body.
In his wound or anything?
No, sir.
Wow. That's just highly suspicious. Now, let's talk about the cap for a second. You know for a fact that Sonny Bono was wearing a knit cap and goggles when he went up the mountain.
Yeah, yes, our understanding was, and there was photographs of him that day, and he's wearing a knit cap and standard goggles. I finally talked to the district attorney down there. He said that he thought that he had seen a report that said nothing. There's nothing. The cap is no place. The goggles, the district attorney had said that he thought he had read one description that said that the goggles were there and were only damaged slightly on the right side. Now, if you go 30 miles into a tree and kill yourself, the right side, he only has a simple black eye. There's no other serious injury. And I would imagine you'd really have a serious amount of cuts in the face and the eye and the nose area, and the goggles would be smashed and all of that if in fact, it had happened the way they said.
Well, not to mention the fact that if you hit something, your body's going to cartwheel around. You're going to pinwheel around.
Here we go. Next point. When you mention that, you're absolutely right. When he was discovered, which, by the way, it was dark before he was discovered. When he was discovered, he was found with his head and face up close to the tree itself that he theoretically had hit, with his right arm forward and up around the tree. Both skis and both poles were still in his hands and on his feet. They were not even disrupted. And I figure the reason that his right arm was up and forward and around the tree was that after they killed him, they grabbed that right arm, dragged him on up to the tree, dropped him down, and took off.
And we're gonna have to leave that here because that's all the time we have. But I want to see if we can't reschedule you again in the future, Bob. You keep investigating, and we'll have you back on again because I know we're just beginning to tell the story of the murder as you see it of Sonny Bono. So thank you for giving us this much time, and know that we won't stop either. Very curious indeed. And a perfect setup for our next guest on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.